We are going from the Arctic to the Antarctic on the show right now. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us. The weather guy's back with us. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, both professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. We'll talk with them about the ozone hole and the ice, the sea ice. We'll also take a look at fall weather forecasts. And, of course, we'll take your questions and take a look at your photos, too. If you have a photo and a question, you could email us at ideas@wpr.org. If you have just want to phone in, that's great, too. I hope you will. The number there is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Steve Ackerman, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be back here again.
And John Martin, thank you for coming by as well.
It's great to be here.
We have that ozone hole over Antarctica starts forming about this time of the year, doesn't it, Steve?
Yep, it begins in August, and it's starting to develop. Right now, its median size is about the same as what it has been historically. But what we've been seeing over the last, well, at least since 2012, that the size of that has been smaller than what it was prior to the development of the Montreal Protocol to try and limit CFCs.
And so, and why is that the case, do you think?
We think it's due to the, you know, before the Montreal Protocol, people were using CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, to do refrigeration, and then there was an international agreement to kind of get that out of refrigerations and aerosol cans. So there's been less in the atmosphere and the ozone hole since about 2012. Has not been as large. And it's not a really a hole. We call it a hole. It's just a reduction in the amount of ozone over Antarctica.
And that's a good thing?
And that's a good thing.
Really,
you know,
good
and
thing.
It just shows that, you know, people can get together and come to agreements that actually can influence the globe.
Yeah, exercising expert judgment, scientific rationale, and then make important policy choices. It actually works.
It actually works. It can work.
This it is can
a demonstration
work. Yeah.
That it can work. Well, so that's good. But we'll have to see as this, usually the size gets largest in September sometime.
Okay.
So we'll have to, it's just started that rate, but, you know, it's been good news for the last seven or so years. So.
So we go to the other side of the planet, and we're seeing a lot of loss or less sea ice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big deal. That changes everything about the, you know, the northern hemisphere of winter and fall and spring even. The sea ice is a big part of the climate system. It provides a platform on which early season snow can fall, of course, and not melt, and then begin to reflect solar radiation away and cool the pole in the way that it's supposed to cool. And what we're seeing is that the ice extent, how far out from the North Pole it extends, is getting smaller almost every year. It's not every single year, but this year right now, 2019, may be the second smallest sea ice extent by the end of the month of September, or middle September, I think, is when it starts to refreeze on the periphery. So we got about 2 or 3 weeks to go yet to see whether or not we'll break the all-time record. It doesn't look like we will, but we're going to get really close, and we'll be the second smallest sea ice extent in the satellite era, which is now 41 seasons.
Yeah.
So
right.
That's
yeah,
a lot.
Not...
And so that creates, less ice creates problems.
Causes a lot of problems. It probably means more snowfall at high latitudes along Siberian, Russian coasts, maybe even northern Canada. So that makes their winter maybe set in a little bit earlier, and then snow on the ground in certain places in the northern hemisphere a little earlier than normal would mean it's easier to produce cold air masses early in the cold season, and some of them may find their way southward over our longitude and give us cold air outbreaks. So it's ironic but possible that with less sea ice in the late summer and early fall, we end up with a higher chance of seeing a lobe of exceptionally cold air get manufactured and move southward over us sometime during the wintertime. So that's one thing. Then open ocean water absorbs a lot more radiation than does the sea ice. And a consequence of that is, of course, the ocean itself gets warmer, and it makes it harder during the freezing season, the wintertime, for the ice to reestablish itself. And that changes a lot about the ecosystems up there, which are fragile and quite well. Although they're all well-balanced everywhere on Earth, but they're fragile up there because they're so dependent on the ice. So there's a lot of things that start rolling down the hill in the wrong direction if you get rid of the sea ice.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting, I think, that, you know, we just talked about the two ends of the of the Earth, the two poles, the Arctic and the Antarctic. And in one case, in the Antarctic, we knew that science demonstrated that human activities were causing the ozone hole.
Yeah.
World got together, came up with protocols and policies that are now addressing it, and successfully. On the other hand, we know scientifically that global warming is being caused by human activities, and we, as a world, haven't been able to get together and come up with policies that can kind of reduce this.
And I think it's a really good point you're making there. There's a tension that's difficult to reconcile, and it might be even more difficult to reconcile at the polar regions in the Northern Hemisphere because it's not there's no continent there. So if you could imagine a summer ice-free Arctic, there are commercial interests around the globe that would be thrilled by that. It'd be a lot easier to move things from Northern Europe over to Asia and back and forth if you can cut across the pole in a ship as opposed to going all
Panama
the rest
Canal,
of
all
the
way down.
Right, exactly right. So there's a lot of tension on that, and it's critical that we get this problem solved. We got a proposal, a couple of colleagues of mine and I are going to submit to the National Science Foundation. It's due 2 weeks from today. That will be part of a major field program. They'll go up and investigate these late summer, early fall Arctic cyclones that can do damage to the ice and put it in a position where it has a hard time recovering. So we hope to be involved in that. If the proposal is accepted and funded, we'll be up there for a dry run next summer and then for the full six-week field program from July 1 to August 15th of 2021. Hoping for, and it's a good bet, we'll get one or two major Arctic cyclones in that period of time and get a real good look at them.
And so you'll be up there?
Yeah, for at least three of those weeks if everything goes the way we hope it does. Yeah.
Where? Where are you going to be stationed?
Well, we don't know yet. It's either going to be in Thule, Greenland, which would be one good spot. There's a couple other places. It might be Barrow, Alaska, and it might be, I can't remember, it's not Spitsbergen. It's not big enough for an airport, but somewhere else up in Scandinavia.
Maybe.
We don't know which one of those three. And we've been asked to budget for the most expensive, and we can always pull back if it gets cheaper, and the NSF would be happy about that. So that's what we're going to do.
John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our guests today, our weather guys, as we talk climate and weather with them. You can join in with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Just to go back to that melting and so forth, you were talking about the changes. That polar vortex that we had, was that really kind of a result of that, or was that something totally different?
No, I'd be hesitant to say that it was a result. I'd be almost as hesitant to say it had nothing to do with it, so that it was totally different. I think there's something connecting them. My guess would be that it's the early season snowfall in various parts of the Northern Hemisphere that's encouraged by a wider open sea extent in the polar seas than used to be the case, that can get cold air manufactured, change the circulation in such a way as to make it perhaps more likely in certain locations, and it won't be the same location every year, but in certain locations in a given season to see an exceptional cold snap. So I think there might well be a physical connection between the two.
Hopefully we're not going to get another one of those.
Well, I hope we do. They're so interesting.
You're talking to the wrong guy, Larry.
Yeah. This last one's got a whole other idea in my head about a proposal on that one. That's so interesting.
Well, what about what we've had so far this summer? How's it shaped up weather-wise?
You know, it's kind of interesting in terms of the climate in this summer because our temperature and precipitation in comparison to climate, and I put that in air quotes, which is the average between, 1980 and 2010 now? Is that the 30-year period?
Yeah, that's right.
It's about average. You know, I would have thought that it would have been colder than average, but our average temperature has been pretty much what we would expect in comparison to that 30-year period.
And I don't know. I wish I'd looked this up. I didn't even think about it. I don't know how many days we've had over 90 Fahrenheit in Madison. I'd be willing to bet it was one. And I'd even not be surprised if it was zero so far. But we've been close a few times. But I don't think we have certainly not had any stretch of consecutive days over 90.
Right.
That hasn't happened.
What I did look up is the median or the mean is about the same as what we would expect in the 30-year average. The daytime maximum was actually a couple of degrees cooler.
So it's warmer
period.
Overnight.
So it's warmer.
And the dew point's higher.
Yep.
I feel like I've been sweating more all summer this summer than usual, given the lack of 90-degree temperatures.
Yeah.
I really have noticed that.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's just the humidity's higher.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that would be reflected in the overnight highs or lows being higher.
Yeah, I think we haven't gotten many 90-degree days.
I don't know if we've gotten more than one.
Yeah.
We may have had that big thing. I forget when it even was, late July. Hottest day in 7 years. That must have been over 90 regionally, but that was it.
Yeah,
the high humidity was a big issue that day, but I don't think we've had a couple in a row even.
Our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman, both professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, talking with them about climate and weather. And I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. If you've got a cool weather photo, we always love those weather photos, cloud formations and so forth. I hope you'll join in. You can email those to ideas@wpr.org, and we'll take a look at them and talk about them. So that's as well. We are going to take a quick look at the news, the weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with John and Steve. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network, taking a look at climate and weather with our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman, both professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have them with us. Certainly, if you have a question or comment, you can call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us your photo and or question at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Kenneth in Janesville next. See what's on Kenneth's mind.
Yes, I heard that there was a killing frost up north last week, and I was wondering about this being earliest. And I remember last year I was asking about the killing frost being very late, and this is going to be how climate change is going to affect this area of our world.
I'd heard that there was frost up north. I don't know if it was a killing frost, though. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, neither had I.
Yeah, and global warming is extending the growing season, although we are behind in growing degree days this year, I noticed.
Yeah, and plus, I think this is really interesting that from 1 year to the next, you can go from a really late first frost to a fairly early one. Late August is not by any means out of bounds. It's certainly well within the bounds of the normal time in which you get the first one up there. But I would say that the variation from year to year is a lot harder to pin on a global, subtle global change in the climate than it is. It's easier to pin it on just the vicissitudes of the weather.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what we've got this time. You just have a slightly different circulation regime over North America that's kind of made us a little more susceptible to some chilly air. And we're feeling it even in the southern part of the state today, and most of this week is going to stay that way, maybe even next week. So we'll be a little bit cooler than people sometimes associate with Labor Day.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kenneth. Appreciate it. Jim in Wanakee, we go to you next. Hi, Jim.
Thanks for the program.
Sure.
And I have a couple of questions. And one is regarding the timely thing of the Amazon rainforest burning and how that could, in the long run, affect us here in the United States or even in Wisconsin. Because I know that the rainforest is like the lungs of the globe, I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
The second question is, as a citizen and, you know, as people that are being affected, it's here, what can we do as citizens to mitigate the negative effects of climate change and warming, like the flooding and so forth? Like I read in Nature magazine that said something about plant more trees, and that if you're in a flood prone area, that will absorb moisture and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are really good questions. I think, you know, in the Amazon burning, if we take that first, this is the season where they do their burning because it's dry down there. But the amount of burning that's been going on has been huge. And that has a couple of impacts. One is the amount of smoke that gets distributed, but that generally doesn't get distributed globally because it's in the troposphere, and so just weather cycles will eventually take it out in a week or so. One of the things that does happen down there is that the soil is not very deep in terms of the fertility of that soil. And so once you start burning down these forests, it's really hard to reestablish them. And one of the things that these forests do is put water vapor into the atmosphere to cause precipitations. Mm. And that on a global scale, because it is so large of an area of the Amazon, might have, I think modeling simulations have shown that it will have an impact as you deforest and turn it into plains and grasslands.
Yeah, and I think that this comment about that it being the lungs of the globe is true. I think I read somewhere that 20% of the oxygen that's produced by plants of all kinds on the globe is produced in the Amazon rainforest, and much of that's in Brazil. And so that's an enormous amount of oxygen. We got a huge reservoir of oxygen. So, you know, this isn't going to make it difficult to breathe. However, it changes the chemical composition of the atmosphere a little bit. And any little bit that tends toward an increase in the carbon dioxide fraction is not good for anybody on this planet or any animal on this planet. And so, you know, what citizens can do, I think, is simple things are part of the list. Turn the light off when you leave a room, things like that. Maybe take the bus if it's possible instead of taking your own car. All those kinds of things can make a difference. And I'd say to add to that list, vote. Because we definitely are in a world now where there's a group of people with political power around the globe, not just in our own country, who are standing fast against the evidence. And they need to be removed from office in a peaceful way. And luckily, we have a democracy. We can do that with a vote.
Yeah.
Jim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have David, who couldn't stay online, but was wondering about 5G disrupting satellite readers and forecasts. Can you talk about what's going on there, and is it a problem?
Potentially, it's a really big problem. And what 5G is, when they were talking about that, is that, you know, when we use our cell phones, we're transmitting information at a microwave frequency, and that frequency mm-hmm. is also used for example, weather satellites to make observations of the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. And of course, the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere is pretty important for predicting precipitation. So if you don't know where the water vapor is or where it's going, it's going to be really hard to predict the precipitation. And so the satellites, a lot of satellite instruments use those microwave frequencies to distribute information about the atmosphere and its structure and its dynamics. And so the concern is that the administration, FAA, is looking at selling off those frequencies to private industry so that they can develop mobile communication, cell phones, basically.
Yeah.
And so the issue is if that does develop, that it'll interfere with the meteorological use of those frequencies, which we've been using for ever since they were actually identified.
And it's not as if those frequencies are out there doing nothing. They're providing information that especially pays huge dividends in forecasting, in the whole forecasting enterprise. So it's not a good trade-off.
Yeah. And so the estimate on the impact on the forecasting by the NOAA guy, what is his name now? I'm forgetting his name. Who's looking at forecasting? He comes out of Panasonic.
Neil Jacobs.
Yeah. Is that it'll take us back potentially to the 1980s, which seems a little extreme to me. But you know, that's how serious he's looking at this as a problem.
Yeah.
And that's a big problem.
Back to the forecast of the 1980s, I mean, you were doing maybe one-day forecasts that were accurate, and now we're 5- or 6-day forecasts.
The problem is no one remembers that because it's been such a gradual improvement. And, you know, you still get the ringing criticism, I wish I could be wrong 5 times a week and still be paid and all this nonsense.
You'd be fired.
Yeah, keep score. And if you keep score, and if you've been keeping score since 1980, you'd realize we're way past where we were then. And so we don't want to take that step backwards.
Yeah, we don't want to go backwards.
Randall emailed and says, we live between Lafarge and Ontario in north central Vernon County. More often than not, storm systems, both rain and snow, track north and south of us. If our observation is correct, what causes this phenomenon?
I think in the summertime when it's thunderstorms that bring the rain, which is predominantly the case, it's very easy, no matter where you live, to be convinced after a period of time that you hear, you see lightning and you hear thunder and you don't get any rain. And it happens a few times in the summertime because these things are kind of vivid and dramatic storms.
Unless you're having a wedding, and then it will hit you.
then it's a guarantee. But, you know, you can see the evidence before your very eyes that somehow there was weather fairly close to you and it missed you. And if it happens a few times, I think it's very easy to start convincing yourself that it happens systematically. Now, in the wintertime, it's hard for me to imagine that places in the immediate vicinity of any location in Wisconsin have dramatically different snowfall totals over the course of a winter. Maybe in an individual event, if you're near the lake or something, that's definitely possible. But by and large, I'd say that's more of a summer phenomena. Projected a little bit toward a winter phenomena. And in both cases, it's probably more your sense of how things are going than the actual statistics would suggest. That's my guess.
You mentioned lightning, and I'm sort of a golf fanatic. Well, not a fanatic.
Yeah, we noticed
but
that.
Fanatic's
the right word, I think.
And this weekend, the big golf tournament, there was a lightning strike, and it somehow managed to get it on film, actually showing the lightning hitting the tree and knocking six people.
Yeah.
Sending six people to the hospital.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Did you see that footage?
My son showed me yesterday. Yeah, I hadn't seen it till he showed me that. Yeah, that was remarkable.
And that's why we say don't go under a tree when it's raining.
Yeah,
and lightning
that's the last place you want to go. Yeah.
There were trees nearby, but that was kind of apart from the other trees, just a little bit, well, probably 100 feet or something.
Yeah.
And just maybe enough for that tree to get picked off.
There was something about that tree and the charge discharge and all that made it the spot, but it's kind of random. You can't tell.
Yeah, and it travels right down into the ground and out the roots.
And these people weren't hugging the tree. I mean, they were in a certain radius of it, and they feel that shock in the ground, and it knocks them
Fortunately,
over.
Fortunately, everybody, I think, is okay.
But, yeah.
It was scary for sure. Yeah. Bill in Wisconsin Rapids, we'll go to you next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'd like to know, do you know what kind of winter we're going to have this year?
Predictions for winter.
You know, these seasonal forecasts are really tough, and so I'm going to let John talk.
I have no idea, Bill. I haven't even been thinking about it, to be honest with you. I'm trying to get ready for this coming semester, and my mind's not been on the winter because I like it so much, I don't like to get myself disappointed. I don't want to peer behind the curtain and feel that I have to be disappointed.
No El Nino that's really strong in these, so there's the good
That's a good thing. Steve, thanks for saying that. That's a really good point. The tropical Pacific Ocean is at least not part of a conspiracy to keep us warmer and wetter than normal. I can say that. Now, I don't know if that makes you happy. It makes me happy. I don't want to do the translation for you. But there's no obvious, a global scale signal that really points in a direction of a non-traditional winter around here. So that is good news. Yeah. And so that probably means we'll see our fair share of some cold spells and a little bit of snow here and there. And I hope we get a little more than a little bit here and there. Mm-hmm. So next time, I promise I'll bring that in September. I didn't think about it for August.
Is that the kind of winter you're looking for, Bill?
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, you know what John's going to get, Steve.
Yeah, I know.
He's going to get the Farmer's Almanac
and
take
look
a
it
look,
up.
Look
that's
it
right.
Up.
I mean, that's an assured sure way to it.
I'll grind some chicken bones and sprinkle some nutmeg and then make a forecast like they do.
You know, they're certainly not right 50% of the time.
They're not
why
even
aren't they
as good
fired,
as climatology. Right? It's just a joke.
Jeff in Eagle River emailed. He said, last summer he was with his family at a school playground, a storm approaching, and they noticed that all the girls' hair was standing as it does with static electricity. Yeah. Were they in danger of a lightning strike? And they did leave the playground
away. Smart
that was a good decision.
Right?
Yeah, get down in a crouch on the balls of your feet when that happens.
Get out of there because, that's a sure sign of somewhere in that area is charged up and looking to
trying to build a connection.
Eliminate that, right? Yeah. Trying to build a connection. And so getting out of that area was whatever adult decided to do that. Because I'm sure the kids were like, isn't this cool?
Yeah,
I mean, that's what I would have done if I was that age.
Was a good call, Jeff, for sure. Somebody else wondered about tornadoes. Now we're getting into September. What are the chances? Well, first, I think we may have talked about this last month.
I think
month,
we had like 12 tornadoes or something this year.
Yeah, pretty small
pretty
number.
Much below
small
average.
Number.
Yeah.
And what's the normal for September? Is that not much of a month for tornadoes?
Do you know off the top of your head? I would guess that it goes down quickly. I think August is almost the peak month, and then it goes away fast.
That's what I would think too. Yeah.
But I don't know for sure.
Into winter. But we've had it every month except for February.
Yeah,
so,
true.
You know, there's a chance it'll happen.
Yeah. But,
right. Well, hopefully we won't have any.
No,
of those.
I hope not.
So, John, you talked a little about the research that you're involved in and what you've got planned, which is pretty interesting. Steve, what are you up to?
Well, related to the Arctic is we have a grant that's looking at cracks in the sea ice.
That's so interesting.
Could see those with satellites. And so we've been interested in monitoring them and determining them for the last 20 years or so, because that's when the satellite era, we have really good data to do that. And that's been really interesting. My hypothesis has been, since it's shrinking and getting thinner, that it should crack more.
Mm.
Right? Well, that's not quite what we're seeing.
And
so it's complicated because, you know, all of a sudden now you got to really look at, okay, well, what's going to make those cracks? It's not just how thin it is. You need these forces.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So is the force coming from the atmosphere or is it coming from below, from the ocean? So it went from this very simple hypothesis, as science often does, to scratching our heads thinking, okay, that's, you know, why are we seeing what we're seeing? Why isn't there an obvious statistical trend over these last 25
years? Really interesting problem you got there.
Yeah.
What makes for a good education in your field?
Boy, there's the fundamentals, right? But I think the other thing that really helps, particularly when you get into the research, is curiosity.
Yeah.
Right? Wanting to know what causes this.
And being careful in what you say about what you're observing, you know, and especially when you use instruments and you do it remotely like Steve does with the satellites to such a, you know, high level of expertise, that takes a really special observing set of skills that you have to keep on refining. But yeah, you're right. I think I agree with you on both things. Fundamentals are the key. You got to learn the fundamentals.
And what are the fundamentals?
In our field, the fundamentals are application of the laws of physics to fluids, whether it's water, ice, or the atmosphere. And there's a variety of different nuances about that application that you can learn in an undergraduate degree. And then you apply that to a question based either on observations or on theory that might arise from questions you have about what you learned in the fundamentals, and you just push the envelope. And just as you said, you start out with I think conceptual simplicity is a key. I think a lot of times we're going to have a whole new crop of graduate students coming in this fall. That's going to be the thing I tell them. Don't think you're going to reinvent science. You're going to start out with a simple conceptual idea, and before you know it, it's going to lead you someplace you had no idea, and it's going to effectively reinvent parts of the science without you having really tried to do that. Mm-hmm. And you just got to stay curious and stay on top of the problem and keep on scratching your head and following where it leads. And in your case, leads is kind of a play on words.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the other thing is it's important to remember that data, good data anyway, has no underlying objectives.
That's right.
It's there.
No agenda.
It's no agenda. The agendas are then put on by people. And to be aware not to be putting your agendas on. I mean, it would be so much easier for me to look at this plot of the frequency of leads and say, oh, yeah, no doubt, my hypothesis is proven.
Yeah.
And you can't do that. You got to keep an open mind and not allow your agendas to determine what your conclusions
are. Yeah. And, you know, along those lines, if you did do that, your colleagues in a blind review would say, you can't impose your agenda on this data.
That's right. You'd be fired.
This paper isn't going to be accepted. And that's the way it is. It's intensely critical when you throw your research findings out to the wolves, as it were, your colleagues. They're all looking for reasons to say, no, I don't think you were careful enough about this. So this nonsense that you sometimes hear about, all one has to do is put the word climate in a proposal to the National Science Foundation, it'll be funded. You know, but we're all backslapping each other about how we're pulling it over on the taxpayer. It's utter nonsense because you're constantly attacked for your ideas. You're not praised for them, and you're not rewarded for them right. Unless they are perfectly refined and they pass that scrutiny, and that's hard scrutiny.
So aside from, I think when people think of going to getting a degree in your area, they think, okay, well, I could be a weather person on TV.
Yeah, if they want to do that, they probably want to go to your department.
Yeah, at least visit you guys. That's for sure. Skill, yeah,
right,
yeah, yeah,
get a dual major. Maybe
a
would
dual
be best.
A dual major would probably be best. Yeah. But what about other types of jobs in your field?
Yeah, there are really a multitude of places people can go with our, again, talking about the fundamental degree in atmospheric science. You can spend time at a research lab working on any of the types of problems we've been talking about. You could work for the EPA or the Department of Natural Resources, whether you're an air or water quality specialist. You have to know something about meteorology and the chemistry of the atmosphere and water bodies and so on. The commercial side is quite large. People are making forecasts for tropical commodities all the time. And, you know, if they need a 10-day forecast for what's going to happen to the cocoa in some part of the tropics, they need to know, is this going to be a rainy 10 days or is it not going to be a rainy 10 days? Same with coffee, sugar, all that stuff. And energy. You know, if you're going to have a 10-day cold snap, whoever's first to the draw on that statement is going to make the most money in terms of selling at a high price when the demand's going to be high for, you know, that cold snap. So there's a million different places where a person can go.
So you'd be a consultant to business people in that last...
A lot of houses are actually hiring meteorologists, not just farming them out to consultants, is saying, I want my own in-house team to do this. Insurance companies and reinsurance companies are doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's all over the place.
Yeah,
is there 60% of the economy is directly affected by the weather?
Yep. I mean, yeah, airlines, there's another place where they're hiring, you know, their own meteorologicals.
Yeah.
Well, there's, you know, school's about to start, so there's people thinking about all that. What about financially? Is there any limit or average?
Well, on average, we don't do this to get rich.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although some can. Yeah, it's beginning to sprout. You know, this commodity stuff, commodity trading, Chicago Board of Trade, New York Stock Exchange, the stuff we were talking about, cocoa and tropical futures and so on. That's not a regular, you know, $80,000 a year job. The same with the energy future market is enormously lucrative. And then some of the other stuff, air quality and whatnot, those are public sector jobs that are really important to society, but they don't get paid well, comparatively.
Yeah,
they don't.
But they're, and even in TV weather people, I don't imagine are.
I think if you get into the big markets,
they're really
New York
big
City,
ones, maybe.
Chicago,
yeah.
Detroit, stuff like that.
So, what's your final word for the coming month or two in terms of weather?
I would say the month of September is going to, at least through the first half of it, seem cooler than people expect. That's what it looks like to me. And I'm happy about that because I'm going to be wearing a tie and a shirt just like Steve is starting on Tuesday and a jacket on top of it. I don't want that to make me sweat like I did all summer long. So I want it to be cool. And it looks like it will be through about September 10th, 11th minimum.
Yeah.
So that's okay.
And I would say enjoy it no matter what it is.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
That's real good advice.
Guys, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure. You'll be back the last Monday. Well, that's September 30th.
Oh, that's a good day.
That's the last Monday of the month.
It's literally the last day as well.
Yeah, that's right.
On that note, thanks again, guys. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Thank you.
John Martin and Steve Ackerman, both professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. They'll be back on September 30th, and we'll do it all over again. Tomorrow at this time, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk's back to talk about the problems of dogs swimming in algae-filled ponds, among other things, and an artificial sweetener that's now being added to some peanut butters that's causing problems. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store. I'm Larry Mueller.